Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, hello, good afternoon, and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate as part of Faith Explored every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio. And if you haven't heard of the programme before, apart from asking what sort of rock you've been living under all these years, you can, of course, find more info about it at the website premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Loads of past shows, ways to get in touch, and of course subscribe to the podcast, and links to this year's Unbelievable the Conference 2017 happening on Saturday the 13th of May. We're really looking forward to a wonderful day of learning from all kinds of different people in central London that day as we look at good reasons for the Christian faith and how to respond to other worldviews such as atheism and Islam. And of course John Lennox, who's an Oxford professor and Christian thinker, is going to be with us for the day. Always a fantastically popular speaker. So if you'd like to book tickets in, this is really your last week to get hold of our special early bird price. That ends on Monday, the 13th of March. The ticket price will go up after that. So I do encourage you, if you've been thinking about it, but you haven't quite got around to booking in for the conference, do it before Monday, the 13th of March, and you'll benefit from the lower price before the price goes up a bit. Find out more at premier.org.uk/whyChrist. And I'm pleased to announce that John Lennox will be with me on next week's programme, and I'm inviting your questions. We're doing a Ask John Lennox Anything edition of the programme, but I'll need to have your questions soon if you'd like to ask him a question about anything. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you can leave me a message via Facebook or Twitter. Do it that way as well. I'll need them though before the end of this weekend. That's before the end of Sunday the 5th of March. So if you can get them into me quickly, then you may well get your question asked of John Lennox on next week's programme. We'll be hearing, of course, some of your thoughts to recent editions of the programme at the end of today's show. But right now, time to get into today's debate.
You're unbelievable.
Well, welcome along to today's edition of the programme that aims to get you thinking every week. Today, debating Jesus, Krishna, Hinduism, and many paths to God. We're asking, was Jesus more than just a spiritual leader in the line of so many others down the ages? Interesting discussion for you today as Ken Samples joins me. He's a Christian philosopher and theologian, a senior research scholar at Reasons to Believe, and the author of several books, including Christian Endgame and Seven Truths That Changed the World. Now, his latest book, God Among Sages, Why Jesus is Not Just Another Religious Leader, is one in which he compares and contrasts Jesus with other religious characters and leaders down the ages, Buddha, Krishna, Confucius, and Muhammad. And he's going to be discussing that today with Deepan Rajaguru, who's a Hindu and director of Equalities and Diversity for the Hindu Council UK. He's going to be explaining why Hindus do revere the character of Krishna, his role in that religion, and why he views the person of Jesus more as an enlightened teacher, but not necessarily the only true revelation of God. And to that end, we're going to be discussing things like why Deepan believes there are many paths to God, and why Ken would say that actually the only true way to God is Jesus. So Ken and Deepan, welcome along to today's program.
Well, thank you, Justin. Pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you both. Ken, we'll begin with you as you're the person who's coming on with the book to talk about. And then I'm really pleased that we've got Deepan as well joining us to talk about his perspective on these things. You've been on the show before in previous years, Ken, but this new book, it looks fascinating. Have you learnt a lot in the process of researching this and looking into other religious figures from down the ages?
I certainly learned a great deal. I think that there is a real need in our time, maybe especially, to look at who Jesus is and and then to do some comparing and contrasting with what I might call the religious faces in the crowd. And so I learned a great deal about Krishna, about the Buddha, Confucius, and even Muhammad. So it's been a pleasure to research, and it's, of course, always very pleasing to see the book out in print.
Absolutely. What particularly made you want to go down this line? I know that previous books you've looked at the Christian worldview in various ways. What made you want to do this comparison and contrast kind of exercise?
I think the origin of the book really came when I was teaching philosophy and religion at a public college here in the United States. And I inevitably have Muslims, Hindus, Buddhist Christians in my classes, and they would inevitably discover that I held Christian views, and they would want to know, well, how does Christianity differ with Hinduism or Buddhism, and how does Jesus differ? So I thought, boy, I would love to have a book that I could give to people, but also to have a fair and careful study between the different religions at a time when it's very important for religious people to be respectful of one another.
I think many people these days, more than in any previous generation, are likely to know people and have friends who are of other religions. There probably was a time, you know, in the US, in the UK, when, by and large, you could be a Christian and not necessarily really know anyone who wasn't a Christian. Now, that still may be true in certain parts of the USA, but certainly where I live in London, you know, it's very cosmopolitan, multicultural, in a sense pluralistic, in the sense that there are a plural number of worldviews on offer as you walk down the road, as you interact with people. I don't know whether that's reflected where you live in California, Ken. Are you likely to encounter people who may have a different worldview to you in these kinds of ways?
Yeah, absolutely. I live in a suburb of Los Angeles, which is one of the most diverse ethnically, religiously, probably anywhere in the United States. And I would say for many people, 50 years ago, if you wanted to talk to a Hindu or a Muslim or a Buddhist, you may have to go overseas. But that's definitely changed in the major population centers here in America, and maybe especially Los Angeles.
And has that presented a problem that perhaps didn't exist, or at least didn't present itself to previous Christian generation, where, I don't know, the fact that suddenly you realize, there's a whole swathe of people out there who are raised in a completely different religion, may not even have heard of Christianity. And I think for some people that immediately presents a sort of a big moral / religious dilemma of well, how can that be? You know, when I was not really aware of them, things made sense. Perhaps it does cast some sort of a question mark over, have I got the right religion? Am I just believing what I believe because of where I was born and so on? I mean, are those the kinds of issues that you think tend to be raised by the fact that we do now live in a multicultural world?
I think it does raise challenges. I mean, it's no longer simply, am I a Protestant or a Catholic or Eastern Orthodox? But obviously, these religions have a very different orientation about God, very different view of Jesus, different orientation of the human predicament, sin, etc. And I think that it's critical that Christian people are able to have interaction, because today you may have a Muslim in your college class, you may have a Hindu family that's part of the soccer team, and so when we talk about Jesus, I think a critical apologetic issue is, how is Christianity true in the light of all of these other religions and the claims that they make? And I would say, working here at Reasons to Believe, which is largely a science-faith apologetic organization, I would say as important as science is in its interface with Christianity, I think the question of how does Christianity relate in its truth claims to these other religions, I think that's maybe one of the most important apologetic questions.
Well, I'm really looking forward to diving into this because we do an awful lot of debates between atheists and Christians, as I'm sure you're aware, Ken, on the programme. And we do fewer, if I'm honest, between people of other faiths. Often it is Islam and Christianity. And it's been a long time, I must confess, since we've had a Hindu on the programme. So I'm so pleased to be joined on the programme today by Deepan Rajaguru, who's from the Hindu Council UK. Deepan, welcome along to the show. Have you always, would you always have described yourself as a Hindu?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me here. I'm pleased to be here. Yes, I describe myself as a Hindu. I guess in terms of the definition of Hinduism and what it generally means, it's a religion or a way of life, essentially. It's a way of life, and it's generally referred to as the oldest practiced religion in the world. And some people, practitioners like myself and Hindus, often refer to it as the Sanatana Dharma, which translates itself as the eternal law. Most of you listeners possibly would know that the term Hinduism was a term given to people who were practicing Hinduism by people who were coming over the Indus River, Indus Valley, the term Hindu was actually given to those group of people who were practicing the Sanatana Dharma. But it's fine. Hinduism is we're fine with the term Hinduism as well. But I guess it perhaps relates to the actual nature of the belief system in terms of how open and accepting it is of teachings of many great people and many enlightened people.
Before we get into a discussion on, and I'd be glad to find out about the history of Hinduism and the role that Krishna has played in the religion, what kind of some of the typical markers of the practice of Hinduism? What sort of activities might a Hindu be involved in on a week-by-week basis?
Right. Hinduism itself is quite a personal religion, quite a personal belief system. We are not dictated to go to temples, although there are many temples and temples hold many ceremonies. But we're not dictated to actually go to temples or to do anything specific. There are certain tenets of Hinduism, as in peace to all mankind and peace to yourself, and Gandhi took this up in the terms of ahimsa, meaning non-violence. So it's something, some tenets which we adhere to, certainly in terms of non-violence, peace to all mankind, and accepting all people, and seeing the divinity in each other, and respecting each other as a soul being.
And in terms of the sacred texts and some of the practices, I had a friend who was a Hindu when I was a young child, and I do remember that they had a shrine. I don't know if that's the right word, in their home.
Yes.
Where they would burn incense and make offerings to certain gods in Hinduism. He was learning to read in the language and being able to read the books, and obviously attending the temple as well. So would those be typical kind of practices for a Hindu?
Yes, generally Hindu families would tend to have a temple or a place of worship or a shrine somewhere within the house, they would tend to go to ceremonies and functions held at temples. Birth, deaths and marriages, the same with, I guess, with most religions, are held within temples or churches, the ceremonies. So it's somewhere where people will congregate for peace, or pleasure or mourning, essentially. And there are certain things which Hindus wouldn't do. For example, we wouldn't we hold the cow as a sacred animal, so it's something that we would not eat or refrain from eating, beef, for example, but that sort of, in terms of the practicalities of catering or meeting the needs of Hindu communities, that would be one such thing where you would know that, hang on, you're not going to serve beef at a gathering where there's Hindus, or similarly where you would not serve pork where there's gatherings of Jews and Muslims. Yeah. But in a sense, it's quite broad. It doesn't have strict adherences which people would must stick to.
Sure. When offerings are being made to gods at a shrine or perhaps, you know, in a temple or whatever, what's going on there as far as you're concerned? Who is the Hindu praying to at that point, and what are they hoping to achieve by making an offering?
Right, it essentially offering the food or whatever it is in praise and in respect of having that food. Most religions would. In Hinduism, it's often given to in a shrine. It's often given to an idol of a god. But this is where it gets complicated or there are misinformations. Hindus believe in one true God. That's something which really needs to be put across, is Hindus only believe in one true God who is formless, limitless, eternal. And that's what we believe in. There is one. There are many aspects of the divine which can take form in terms of a God being, which has aspects of the divine. So there'll be certain gods with various specific powers, for example, or which, if you want to feel that you need that certain power, then you would offer food or want blessings from that particular deity. But it's only one particular manifestation or aspect of the supreme being that you're praying to.
You wouldn't necessarily sort of describe Hinduism as polytheism then. It ultimately it is monotheism in as much as all of these aspects are found in the one divinity.
Yes, it would be that. However, it's quite a wide encompassing religion. It can encompass atheism, agnosticism, all manner of things within the broad concept of Hinduism. But there is a firm belief in that there is a supreme being.
Okay. Just take us then, and I want to give you time here to sort of lay out, because I know that for many of the audience, and myself included, may have very little familiarity with Hinduism. But so before we do come back to Ken, just it's a very ancient religion, as I understand it. And yeah. And what kind of was the genesis, would you say, the foundational sort of aspect of Hinduism? And what does the key character of Krishna play in the religion?
Right. I mean, in terms of when it was founded, there is no specific or single date from when it was founded. It derives from the Vedic tradition, which was around during the Harappan and Mohenjo-daro Indus Valley civilizations, the first civilizations. It was around during those times. So it has very ancient roots. But there are certain aspects of Hinduism and certain stories which can be dated and be given specific timelines. So it's a very ancient religion in that sense, which has no specific beginning. It believes in cycles, where everything goes round, and hence many people have heard of the concept of karma, you know, in its broadest sense, it means that what comes around goes around, essentially. But again, the concept of karma in itself is quite deep and quite meaningful. However, it's taken within the West, it's essentially what comes around goes around. And again, in most religions, you know, I think in I believe in Christianity, when it says, you know, do not do to others or that.
Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and so on.
That's right.
Yeah. Just describe then what role Krishna plays specifically in Hinduism.
Right. Krishna is an avatar, which means where the God in himself, herself comes to Earth. So it's actually God incarnated, an avatar is God incarnated on Earth. So Krishna was God incarnate on Earth.
And what do you have in terms of the life of Krishna? Do you have that recorded?
Yes, I mean there are many historical texts which refer directly to Krishna. Certainly in the Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita, which are sacred texts in Hinduism, Krishna is referred to in that. In terms of history, there have been other people, Greek scholars, who have come and gone to India, who have talked about Krishna, and apparently there's, from what I know, there's coinage, Indo-Greek coinage, which depicts Krishna.
Mm.
So there was a being called Krishna who did live on Earth many centuries ago.
And in what sense, you know, you say he was the incarnation in the sense, in a special way, of God. What mm-hmm. does that mean for you then as a Hindu? Do you pray to Krishna? And what did he achieve, as it were, during his lifetime?
Yes, I mean, I certainly pray to Krishna, and generally Hindus would pray to a form of Krishna because he did many amazing things. During his lifetime, he was incarnated as God to ensure that evil does not rise, or evil is stopped. So whenever there is a rise of great evil, God incarnates himself or herself to get rid of that evil. So we certainly believe in that. And Krishna is an avatar of the Supreme Being. Who we pray towards because of the qualities he had as well. He had many qualities.
Right. Well, I'm sure we'll learn more as we go along in the program today, and we'll be able to enjoy the discussion that you're going to have with Ken Samples. Thanks for joining me on the program today, Deepan.
You're welcome.
That's Deepan Rajaguru, who's Director of Equalities and Diversity for the Hindu Council UK. Ken, what did you learn specifically about Krishna in the course of your research for this book, God Among Sages? And was there anything that his character held in common with other religious sort of leaders of other faith traditions?
Undoubtedly, Krishna is the most popular religious figure in Hinduism. I think some of the things that I learned that are important from a Christian point of view is that there are Hindu scholars who have doubts about Krishna's historical existence. That is, Hinduism is tied more deeply to mythology than to historical chronology. And in terms of, you know, Krishna's character, he seems unusual in the sense that you get various portraits of Krishna. He appears as a infant dancing child. He appears as a youth. But he also appears as a kind of a prankster, almost playboy adolescent who seduces the cow maidens. And then in the Bhagavad Gita, he appears as a counselor to a general before a major battle, and ultimately God. And from a Christian point of view, I'm kind of puzzled how all of these portraits, you know, how they're tied together ultimately. And in terms of comparing Krishna and Jesus, I don't think Krishna compares terribly well. Of course, I don't think anybody compares well with Jesus. That's the point of Christianity. But in terms of Krishna's character, I don't see him as a deeply holy figure. I don't see him as an individual necessarily who even keeps Hindu ethics. So I think there are questions that I have about Krishna's historicity, about his moral character, and I also wonder, what does Krishna do for people? I mean, Christ, in a Christian sense, Christ dies to save his people. Jesus is a god with wounds, if you will. What does Krishna do to change, let's say, the nature of a person's relationship with God in the afterlife? So, I also have questions about. I know Deepan said that Hindus believe in one true God, but my question is, I know Bhakti Hindus believe in what is roughly monotheism, but there are temple Hindus who believe in 330 million gods. There are Advaita Hindus who say that all reality is one and that one reality is God, so a monism, pantheism. I'm not sure how all of these views of the nature of God can be true. So those are some of the challenges that I see in Krishna and Hinduism.
We've only got a couple of minutes, but before we do go to a break, Deepan, maybe just to begin to unpack this, what's your response firstly to the historicity issue? Is that kind of an issue for you, or just not something particularly bothers you, whether you can or can't sort of prove the historical nature of Krishna?
I mean, personally, it does not bother me one bit. However, in terms of proof, and people want proof of all this. I mean, there is emerging proof. I mean, I mentioned earlier historical records, non-Hindu historical records which depict Krishna. I mean, the city of Dwarka is being discovered under the water, for example. But regardless of this, before I knew all of this, I mean, to be honest, Krishna as a being, as he came on Earth, he did many great things to alleviate people suffering and ensure that he was able to do that, alleviate suffering and bring goodness onto Earth. He had many aspects of his own divinity from as Ken mentioned quite rightly, from being a child, from an infant to a youth, to an adolescent, to a man in that sense. And each aspect of those are particular aspects of his own divinity and how great he was. And there are stories, I mean, in Hinduism, there is within texts which say, you know, states what amazing things he was able to do as an infant, and advise during the time of a great war in the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, we'll come back to this, Deepan. So stay where you are, and we'll come back to Ken samples as well. We're talking about Jesus, Krishna, Hinduism, and whether there are many paths to God in the end. It's comes out of a discussion we're having around Kenneth Sample's new book, God Among Sages, Why Jesus is Not Just Another Religious Leader. He's in conversation with Deepan Rajaguru, who is my guest, who's a Hindu on the program today. So come again in just a moment's time. We'll be continuing today's discussion here on Unbelievable.
How can I know it's true?
What about other religions?
Why Christ? Join me, Justin Brierley, to find answers at Unbelievable The Conference 2017. Discover how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe, and everything, and how to share him with others. Plus, I'll be launching my new book and sharing why I'm still a Christian after 10 years of talking with atheists. It's in London on Saturday the 13th of May with great speakers, including Professor John Lennox, Beth Grove, Andy Bannister, and Jeremiah J. Johnston of our conference partner, the Christian Thinkers Society. Early bird tickets are available now at premier.org.uk/whychrist.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. Here on Unbelievable, we bring all kinds of different worldviews into conversation with each other. We broadcast on a Christian radio station, but we're very much about hosting the conversation between different points of view. Now, often that's me hosting a debate between a Christian and an atheist. Do that a heck of a lot, actually, on Unbelievable. But today, something a bit different. We've got a Hindu joining me. Deepan Rajaguru is a Director of Equalities and Diversity for the Hindu Council UK. He's in conversation today with Ken Samples, who's a Christian philosopher and theologian. He's with Reasons to Believe out in California in the States. And his new book, God Among Sages, Why Jesus is Not Just Another Religious Leader, compares and contrasts Jesus with other characters like Buddha, Krishna, Confucius and Muhammad. So today we're asking who was Krishna in Hinduism? How does he compare to the character of Jesus? And are there many paths to God? Is Krishna, Jesus, are they just different ways of seeing the same thing, that kind of thing? We'll get into those kinds of issues later on. Ken certainly says, as far as he's concerned, Jesus is unique. He is the truth, the way, and the life. And we'll hear more about that in a moment's time. If you want to get in touch about anything you hear on the programme today, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Equally happy to receive your thoughts via the Facebook page, Twitter as well, at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. We'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's programme as well, so do stick around if you can towards the end of today's show. Hear what you had to say about recent editions of the programme. Okay, coming back to you, Deepan, because we had to cut it short a bit there in the last section, but you know, and I think this is the kind of program where you know we have to just acknowledge we have differences of opinion on our religious perspectives, and that's not at all to be dismissive or anything. But I think Kenneth genuinely has these questions about Krishna. He finds it difficult to pin down the historicity there. He says seems to crop up in different characters, and how do you piece those together? And I think what you were saying, Deepan, is essentially you're sort of seeing Krishna in different sort of stages of life being depicted there. It was kind of what I got from you. I mean, there is this moral question, says Kenneth, though. He's not convinced, in compared to Jesus, for instance, that Krishna displays the kind of moral character that one would perhaps look to from a major religious leader like that. What makes you convinced that Krishna does have, you know, these unusual moral features? What particular things would you point to, for instance?
I mean, there is lots of throughout his life, from birth to childhood to adolescence, there are many great parables about Krishna and the great things he achieved. I mean, morally, I mean, one of the greatest writings and acknowledge, i.e. the Bhagavad Gita, you know, talks about the conversation between Krishna as a charioteer to Arjun, who's fighting a great war. And there are many issues, moral issues, which confront him. For example, you know, he's fighting his own cousins, his own flesh and blood. And, you know, asking Krishna questions around the morality of the war, of you know, being in fighting with people he knows, his own flesh and blood. Lots of great moral questions. I mean, the whole Bhagavad Gita is this conversation within the greater tome of the Mahabharata. The Bhagavad Gita is specifically a conversation around morals,
right?
Which he's having.
And I mean, coming back to you then, Ken, what is your contention that, and again, not that you're being arrogant here, but simply this is your view, I suppose, that all that being said, for you, Jesus is a superior moral sort of person in as much as perhaps the things he said and did still reverberate through history in a way that perhaps the Krishna does not. I'd just be interested to hear what your comparison is here between Krishna and Jesus in terms of their moral character.
Yeah, very good. Justin, I would say that I ask myself the question, what would I expect God to be like if he made an appearance in the world? Because Hindus believe Krishna is an avatar. Christians believe that Jesus is the incarnate Son of God. I think with Jesus, he has the character that I would expect of God. Even Jesus' enemies could not find moral fault or flaw with him. Even Pontius Pilate, his ultimate one who would sentence him to death, could find no moral flaws. Jesus is engaged in the miraculous. He has compassion, healing people, lepers, people who can't walk, people who can't speak. He is a profound teacher. And then he deals, I think, with the great issue of life, and that is with the issue of death. How do human beings live in light of the fact that we will die? In terms of that comparison, either with Buddha, Confucius, Muhammad, or in this case with Krishna, I don't see the qualities and characteristics in Krishna. I mean, Krishna as a youth kind of engages in, you know, he's stealing butter. He is he's lifting up the mountains. The miracles that he does don't seem to relate to the great need of people for healing and comfort. And I am troubled by the idea of what are the escapades that Krishna is involved with, the cow maidens. That doesn't seem like Krishna has a high view of women. With regard to Jesus, Jesus has an extraordinary view of women. He doesn't scapegoat them. He sees them as having full dignity with men. He has women followers. So I think that a fair comparison, and I never want to misrepresent any of these religions because, frankly, I don't want my religion to be misrepresented. But I think in terms of Jesus' claims, his character, his credentials in terms of divinity, he's what I expect God to be like. I don't think Krishna fills the bill, with all due respect to my Hindu friends.
Okay. What do you think? Ken has misrepresented Krishna there, Deepan?
I think Ken's taken a very perhaps naive, if I can say that, with all due respect, view of Krishna and the parables around Krishna, because you know they always have a deeper meaning in terms of the stories and what people gain and get from these stories. And the great things that Krishna did, and it's one of the things perhaps which I think which may distinguish, or I'm trying to get to grasp with, and I mean this with all due respect, is the question around Jesus: is he the incarnate Son of God, or is he God incarnate? Because In Hinduism, like I say, Krishna is God incarnate, and this there is a difference between, from what I'm hearing, if Jesus is a son.
You're not quite sure whether Jesus makes quite the same kind of claim, or the Christian claim about Jesus is the same. You're saying that the fact that Christians describe Jesus as the Son of God, is different to Krishna claiming to be the incarnate God. Ken, is that an important distinction for you?
I would say quite clearly, whether you're Catholic, Orthodox, or Protestant, you believe that Jesus is God in human flesh. You know, the point we're making there is that Jesus is a single person. He has both a divine and human nature. Justin, I think a real difference between the incarnation from a Christian point of view and avatar from a Hindu point of view, the incarnation happens one time. Avatars happen many times and will happen again in the future. The incarnation is a historical event confirmed not only by the gospel writings, New Testament epistles, but also Jewish, Roman, and Greek authors. The avatar, in my view, seems heavily tied to mythology. So Plus, Jesus is a distinct person. He is one person with both a divine and human nature, but the natures don't blend or mix. My understanding of avatars is that a deity could appear even in an animal form. So I think the idea of avatar and incarnation are very different, but in incarnation, carne is a Latin word for flesh. Jesus has come in human flesh. He is God in human flesh, a single person with both the divine and human nature.
I'd give you an opportunity to respond to that, Deepan. Is that a fair kind of contrast between what we're talking about?
Oh, no, that's a good clarification, because I was simply asking what was meant, because it does get confusing for non-Christians,
such as
myself, because, you know, it's all, Jesus is always referred to the Son of God. And as Hindus, we would readily accept Jesus as a divine being, certainly in terms of what he's taught and what he did. So we would have no issue.
Do you, in that sense, see Jesus as another avatar? In that sense,
Not another avatar, but certainly a enlightened being, such as the Buddha and other instigators of great religions, such as Jainism and Sikhism, Guru Nanak, etc.
The same line as Ken of Jesus being God incarnate, then, but you would see him as some kind of enlightened religious leader who was inspired by God.
Totally, and with all respect due, you know, if a person, enlightened being a person who is enlightened and lives a good life is something to learn from, and that's what Hinduism is about. It's about finding ways in which you can learn.
And as I understand it, again, from having had conversations occasionally with Hindus, and indeed from hearing of Christians who speak to Hindus, it's really not terribly missionary or seeking to convert people to Hinduism. I think many Hindus that I meet are very happy to say, you've got your view, Justin, that's your path to God, good on you. If you think that is what Jesus is, I'm not going to object to that. In that sense, it's very pluralistic. It's very, you know, many paths to God. And for you, is that simply the case that any conception of God can lead to God in that sense?
As you probably know, that the saying that wise men know that there is only one God, but there are many paths to God. You know, it's a saying. That's what we would believe, and certainly I would believe. There are many paths to God. Hinduism offers a way of life where you can seek the ultimate being with God. Quite rightly said, Hinduism doesn't seek to convert people. We don't believe in proselytizing. There is... if you want to become a Hindu, you just become a Hindu. You know, you just do the right thing, as we would say. There is no necessary need to go out and convert people, and we would not believe or seek to convert people. We would definitely welcome people. There is no issue. You know, color, creed, race, religion, sex, sexual orientation. All of that, we would readily and happily welcome, and that's, I guess that's where Hinduism comes from. And again, if we look back to India, where Hinduism developed, it's the only country which accepted people from many different religions and races. There's one of the oldest Jewish populations in India. India was the only country at that time which did not discriminate against Jewish people.
Very often that kind of feature of Hinduism may be seen as a bonus, Ken, in today's day and age, which you know wants to celebrate tolerance, and in that sense, a religion which says each to their own may be something quite welcome to many people. Whereas Christianity, of course, very often will appear exclusive because it's making a unique claim about Jesus, saying he is the way, the truth, and the life. What for you? Why would you disagree with Deepin's view that Jesus is just another way to know God in that sense?
Yeah, those are great questions. I think, Justin, categorically, Christians view Jesus as coming into the world as both God and man. And as God and man, he has made a sacrifice for human sin. And so we view the atonement of Jesus, his work on the cross, through the prism of the incarnation. Because he's both God and man, he can reconcile God and man. Now, in terms of the exclusivism issue, I think the idea that all religions are true, or all of these religious leaders can lead to God or to ultimate reality, I think they face intractable problems. I mean, the religions of the world, number one, teach fundamentally different things. I mean, even in Hinduism, is God a god of pantheism? Is it a god of polytheism? Is it monotheism? The religions differ about who God is. Is he personal? Is he less than personal? There are lots of differences about the nature of human beings. Is our problem karma? Is it sin? Is it attachment? What's the solution? Is it faith and repentance? Is it meditation? What is it? These are not minor differences. They're not differences like, should we baptize an infant or an adult? These are major types of issues. Secondly, there's no way of really boiling all these religions down to a lowest common denominator. There's no theme that all the religions can be reduced to, because even ethics, and it's certainly true that Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, Confucianists, kind of all have something like the Ten Commandments, or at least the second five of the commandments, prohibition against illicit sexual relations, telling us to tell the truth, not lying, etc. But those ethical ideas are all rooted in very different metaphysical ideas. I mean, from a Christian point of view, the reason we treat people with dignity and respect is we believe they're made in the image of God, and so theology informs our ethics. I think the last point that makes pluralism an intractable, logical, philosophical, religious problem is that these religions contradict each other. I mean, even the religions that have the most in common, the monotheistic religions of the Middle East, I mean, Jews, Christians, and Muslims can't agree about who Jesus is. Christians say Jesus is God incarnate. Jews and Muslims say he's not. Both of those views can't be true, because otherwise we'd have to get rid of the laws of logic. So Hinduism, in my view, and I'm a student of Hinduism, and I want to understand it in the best way possible and have no intention of misrepresenting it, but it seems to me that Hinduism is really a set of different religions, and there's no kind of coherent perspective on how all of these views of God work together. So I see pluralism as a logical and as a theological conundrum.
Yes. Okay. Come back with this then, Deepin. Ken's point there, not all religions can be true. It just doesn't work, you know. There's different truth claims in all of them. Some of them, you know, are directly in conflict with each other. What's your take on that then? Is it possible for all paths to lead to God when they make such different claims about God?
Well, it's up to the individual, and the individual will ultimately know and seek the truth. But there is this distinction, and Ken quite rightly pointed to it, between Christianity and all religions. And, you know, for example, you know, in Christianity, you know, it said that we are born of sin. In Hinduism, we don't have that concept of being born in sin or the original sin. And again, I guess this is Christianity and not Jesus as you would see it. Because in terms of Christianity defining the image of God, or how the image of God was used by Christians to convert people who are different. I mean, you know, obviously we see the depictions of Jesus. He happens to be, you know, and I don't mean this with any disrespect, you know, a 6 foot tall blonde man, white man. And we know, and if historically, if this is a case, and Ken would put me right here, you know, Jesus would not have been like that. But that image was used, you know, in terms of all manner of things, colonialism, slavery. Again, the Bible, I'm not too sure what part of the Bible, I think it's Leviticus, which condones slavery. And there's other parts of the Bible which we say do not condone slavery. So there are contradictions.
I mean, just returning to the issue of sin, and I'll certainly be interested to hear Ken's response to those other issues you've raised as well. I mean, so as from what you're saying, there's no similar concept in Hinduism of sort of being of original sin or the idea that we're fallen and need saving. But there is, as you said, this idea of karma. What comes goes around comes around. And does that feed into, in Hinduism, a view that people are born within certain stations in life because of what has perhaps gone on in a past life and that kind of thing?
It's what you do with your life which dictates what happens in your life. And that is basic karma. So if you do good, if you are good, and, you know, for example, if you follow the 10 good... If you follow the good, you know, the Ten Commandments, for example, if you're happy to be a good Christian, then ultimately you would be good.
What happens in Hinduism if you aren't good? If you lead a bad life and you come to the end of that life, and you're perhaps you feel bad about having led that life, is there any kind of redemption available? Because obviously in Christianity, that's one of the key things. You can... No matter what kind of life you live, no one is beyond redemption. The offer of forgiveness and salvation is always there. What is there an equivalent in Hinduism, or do you just have to reap the you know the wind of the karma that you've sown?
Yep, you have to pay the price of what you did, good or bad. You reap the reward or pay the price accordingly.
There's no way out in that sense. You are beholden to the law of karma.
There is no instant method of getting out of it in that sense, because what is done has already been put into practice. You know, it's already been done. So if it's set off a chain of reaction, it doesn't matter if you're on your deathbed. You know, if you were, you know, if you happen to be a mass murderer and you killed all these people and then felt bad on your deathbed because of fear of your own soul, because it's essentially
what is the ultimate fate then of someone in that position in Hinduism?
Well, Hinduism, in terms of karma and rebirth and birth, samsara, and the cycle of life, it's for your soul to acknowledge, to experience different things. You will experience being good, bad, everything in your life, and this is why you should not be discriminating against anyone, for example, with a disability, because that would have been you, that could be you. I mean, often karma is seen in a negative light, but it's not. It's actually showing to people that we should not be discriminating, you should lead a good life, because you should be learning from each aspect of your previous life, or would have learned something from that previous life.
Let's just come back to you, Ken, before we've just got a couple of minutes before we have to go to our final break. Is this an aspect of, again, the comparison and contrast you do between Krishna and Jesus and the other leaders in terms of the whether there is a way to come back to God even if you've lived a sort of a terrible life and so on?
I definitely think that a real difference between historic Christianity and Hinduism is this issue of karma and how that affects the next life, reincarnation, etc. I mean, from a Christian point of view, we typically think of morality flowing from the nature of God, that there is an objective morality, and God has built us in his image, made us in his image, and therefore we can recognize moral principles. It seems to me, from a philosophical point of view, that karma seems like an inbred principle that's distinct from all of the so-called deities of Hinduism. In terms of kind of the afterlife issue of living an evil life, a life that violates the principles of God, certainly Christianity has a belief that if you reject the atoning death of Christ, and if you don't want that salvation that is offered in Christ, then you will face the judgment of God. And so we have these challenging and difficult, but I think very clearly biblical ideas that there will be a divine punishment if one is not a recipient of God's grace. But I'm not sure what, you know, again, I would raise the question, and I raise it respectfully. I've really listened carefully to Deepan, and I think I've learned some things, so I appreciate him. But I wonder what is, I know what Jesus does for his believers. He dies for them to reconcile them, to take away their sin. What does Krishna do that changes our status in the afterlife for people who believe? I don't see anything that he does in a kind of redemptive way.
Okay, well, I'm going to let Deepan answer that in a short moment's time. We're going to go to a break first. So hold on there, Deepan, and we'll see what you have to say in response to that question. Again, if you've got questions yourself or some kind of a comment that you'd like to leave about today's discussion, then you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll have some of your responses towards the end of today's show to previous programs. This is Unbelievable, hosting a debate today between a Hindu and a Christian, asking Jesus, Krishna, Hinduism, and many paths to God. What's that all about? We'll be back with my guests, Ken Samples and Deepan Rajaguru, in just a moment. Martin Luther King described 11 o'clock on Sunday morning as the most segregated hour in Christian America. The same is still true today in the UK. In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we explore the great divide between black and white churches and what can be done to unify them again. You'll also meet the wave of refugees seeking asylum and finding Christ, discover why modern archaeology is confirming the New Testament, and find out what tech pioneer Elon Musk has to say to today's church. All that plus much more. Why not ask for a free copy of our March magazine at premierchristianity.com/freesample. Welcome back to the final part of today's programme, and we'll be hearing the final part of the discussion between my guests on Hinduism and Christianity in a moment's time. Just before we get to some of your feedback as well towards the end of today's programme, a reminder that there's some great events coming up. You've obviously been hearing about Unbelievable, the conference 2017. Again, Saturday, the 13th of May, and do book in before the early bird closes on Monday, the 13th of March. But if you want more about that, go to premier.org.uk/Christ. Join me along with John Lennox, Andy Bannister, Beth Grove, Jeremiah J. Johnston, Ruth Jackson, Jamie Cutteridge, Sarah Foster, and others besides. Tim Smith of Museum of the Bible is going to be there as well. And in fact, we're partnering again with Christian Thinkers Society and Museum of the Bible for this year's conference. It's actually called Why Christ? Discover how Jesus is the answer to life, the universe, and everything. And it really promises to help you show the world why, out of all the options on offer, Jesus Christ makes sense, why Christianity makes sense of life's questions. So that's at the Brewery, London, 13th of May this year, and do book in soon if you can. premier.org.uk/Why Christ. Apart from there still being this early bird offer till Monday the 13th of March, there's also that offer for booking two or more tickets gets you last year's conference on DVD for free, so that's worth it too. There's also a group discount option. Lots of ways to save some money if you're attending this year's conference. I should also give a quick shout out again to the Reasons for Hope tour taking place across Ireland in March and into April as well. This is William Lane Craig and John Lennox who are going to be doing this. In fact, William Lane Craig is sort of doing Cork, Dublin and Belfast one week, and then the following week, John Lennox doing Cork, Dublin and Belfast as well. Bill Craig is involved in a couple of debates during that time and also giving some lectures and Q&A. John Lennox giving a number of lectures and Q&A as well in various locations. So if you want more information on that, if you live in Ireland, do go to facebook.com/reasons2017. That'll get you the information you're looking for when it comes to the Reasons for Hope 2017 Island of Ireland tour presented by the Christian Unions of Ireland. Also, a quick shout out to those who may be interested in attending the next London discussion group. The Unbelievable Skeptics and Christians discussion group is meeting on Monday, the 13th of March. Ben Watts, who's an ex-Christian, is speaking on apostasy. The venue is the new one they've been meeting at recently near Euston, Summerstown Coffee House, 60 Cholton Street, NW1 1HS. And Ben is actually going to be responding to something that William Lane Craig has said in the past, that moral and spiritual lapses are the principal cause for failure to persevere in Christian faith rather than intellectual doubts. So he's going to be responding to that in a talk titled Having Doubts, Is Apostasy Principally a Moral or Spiritual Lapse? And so I'm sure there'll be some interesting discussion after that, as there always is, at the Unbelievable Skeptic and Christian Discussion Group, not formally affiliated with this programme, simply something that sprang up organically as show listeners, both Christian and atheist, decided they wanted to get together to talk about some of the issues we often touch on the show. So do check that out. It's at the meetup.com website for more details. Just look for the Unbelievable Christians and Skeptics discussion group. And a reminder as well, speaking of John Lennox being on that Reasons for Hope tour, that John joins me on next week's programme. We're doing an Ask John Lennox Anything edition of the show. We'll be firing a whole load of listener questions at him. Not too late to get yours in. If you can send them to me before the end of the weekend, this Sunday, the 5th of March, I hopefully can be able to ask your question of John. So do get in touch. You can email it in, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can leave me the question on Facebook or Twitter. I've set up a little. You'll see if you go to the Facebook site for Unbelievable at facebook.com/unbelievablejb. You'll see a little graphic I've done for the show in question, and you can leave your question there equally at the Twitter account. That's at UnbelievableJB if you're a Twitter user. Coming up after Unbelievable today, you can hear Sharon Grenham Thompson on The Profile talking to Sam Hales, deputy editor of Premier Christianity magazine. And Sharon is the subject of The Profile in the latest edition of the magazine, and so you can read that as well if you go to our website at premierchristianity.com. But you can hear her talking about her adult conversion to Christianity, how she was drawn towards ministry in the Church of England, and her work as a prisons chaplain as well. So listen out for that between 4 and 5 this afternoon. And worth mentioning again that if you've often heard me by podcast on Unbelievable talking about The Profile but never been able to tune in to Premier Radio to actually listen, we are actually now putting The Profile out every week as a podcast. So if you're interested in checking that out and seeing some of the recent guests, go to premierchristianradio.com/The Profile for the options for how to download the podcast of the programme. Okay, that's enough of that. Time to get into the final part of today's discussion, and we'll be hearing some of your feedback a bit later on.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, as we conclude today's programme, we've been looking at Hinduism and Christianity, and specifically comparing and contrasting two of the major figures. Obviously, in Christianity, that's Jesus. But one of the key figures in Hinduism is Krishna. Ken Samples from Reasons to Believe has a new book out, God Among Sages, Why Jesus is Not Just Another Religious Leader, in which he compares and contrasts Jesus with Buddha, Krishna, Confucius and Muhammad in various different ways. And his contention, put respectfully, but certainly obviously with a measure of disagreement with Deepan, is that Jesus simply morally is in many ways superior to the picture we have of Krishna. And in that last section, also saying Deepan, who joins us from the Hindu Council UK, that as far as he can see, Jesus does something himself. He not only points towards himself as the source of life, but he provides that life by being the sacrifice that reconciles humans and God, allows people to kind of receive forgiveness and eternal life and everything else. That there's a very much a sense in which Jesus' life itself is given in that way and so on. And he doesn't see any kind of reflection of that in Krishna's life. What he says, he doesn't see that Krishna does anything for the believer specifically, more than perhaps just offer some kind of moral example or something. What's your response to that, Deepan?
I mean, Krishna did do a lot in his lifetime for his people, but unlike Jesus, he did not die to wash the sins of others. In Hinduism, you know, in terms of the concept of karma, you have to deal with and learn from your mistakes as a person. Otherwise, you might end up repeating these mistakes. If someone is taking away these sins, you've not learnt much from it. You know, in the same way as you would perhaps teach a petulant child, for example. You know, if you want them to learn from something, they have to take responsibility. And it shouldn't be the parent taking full responsibility, you know, or Jesus in this case. People have their own responsibility to enable people to live with other people, essentially.
Yeah, so in that sense, Krishna or the God kind of leaves it to people to work out their own eventual destiny in that sense.
Yes, they have free will.
Do you want to come back on that, Ken?
Well, I think that, I certainly agree that humans have responsibilities and there is a need to work out the challenges in their life. But I think from a kind of a philosophical perspective, looking at the human predicament, it seems that human beings have a fallen nature. The famous scientist and philosopher Blaise Pascal said that humans are kind of an enigmatic combination of uniqueness and brokenness. It seems that there is real evil in the world. There is fallenness in the world. You know, from my own reflections, I need more than a prophet. I need someone to help resolve the issues that I have as a broken, fallen, sinful human being. I think Jesus' role as Savior is very unique and very attractive, and I guess I again raise that question, what would I expect God to be like if he came in human flesh? And of course, Christians believe that Jesus was both divine and human. I think we see in Jesus' teaching his compassionate healing. I think we see it in his claims, and ultimately his death and resurrection. I mean, if Jesus actually rose bodily from the dead, there isn't any message more important for people to hear. So as I write in my book, I think Jesus is God among sages. I think Jesus towers above the rest. I don't say that as a Christian triumphalism. I say it simply trying to put them side by side and compare them, and to try to be intellectually honest with what I think the answers are.
And obviously that conclusion draws you to want to share that message with others, Ken, including Hindus. You know, you think the best thing a Hindu can do, presumably, is to follow Jesus, to become a Christian in that sense. Now, that obviously is because, you know, Christianity is a religion that seeks converts, that seeks to spread that view. Deepan, do you find that in any way antagonistic? Do you mind the fact that, you know, Ken, whereas you're not really too bothered about what Ken does, you know, he can pursue his path and you're not going to be bothered by that. But Ken would really like you and the people, you know, and other Hindus to come to know and, you know, become Christians and to follow Christ and to trust in Christ's promises and everything else. Is that a problem for you, Deepan?
Yes, in a word, and to perhaps explain it, proselytization, certainly from a historical perspective from the South Asian continent, and from an African continent perspective, did not do any great good historically. So, you know, that's a fact. You know, I mentioned slavery. And this is where I see the difference. I see the difference from my perspective. I see the difference between Jesus as the person and as an enlightened being, and Christianity as the moral code, which essentially may not be related to Jesus's teachings. I know it sounds kind of strange, but for me, we would appreciate Jesus as an individual.
It sounds very much like what Gandhi's purported to have said, which is, I like your Jesus, I do not like your... I like your Christ, I do not like your Christians. It was one of the things he was supposed to have said, you know.
Yes, because, I mean, certainly because our Christians have used Jesus, and the image of Jesus has not been very Christian in that sense. And when you look at the Bible, and when parts of it says, you know, they condemn slavery, you think, yeah, surely an enlightened being such as Jesus would not have said that, and I would not believe he would have said that, personally speaking.
Well, let's pass that across to Ken with the time we've got remaining here. Obviously, Ken, one of the issues that Deepin has there is the history of colonialism and Christianity in terms of missionary activity and so on has had negative consequences in his view. So you might want to answer that. Then he also says, you know, the Bible doesn't speak clearly against, for instance, slavery. It seems to be affirmed in some parts and perhaps not affirmed in other parts. Why didn't Jesus kind of categorically reject that if he's this morally superior character you believe he is? Do you want to just pick up on both of those particular objections?
Sure. Yeah, fair questions. I would first of all say that it is the vast majority of the abolitionists, particularly in the Western world, have been Christian people. So Christians have led a great deal of confronting slavery. And the belief is that humans are made in the image of God. They have inherent dignity and moral worth. You cannot, you should not enslave them. So it is the moral principles of Scripture that led the abolitionists to oppose slavery. I would, though, lend a challenge, a respectful one, to Deepin. The caste system strikes many of us as being quite prejudicial, quite oppressive. I think that the challenge of slavery and prejudice and sin is a human problem. And it is true that, you know, Gandhi liked Christ but didn't like Christians, but that's the Christian message. Christians, like all people, need a savior, not a prophet, not merely a God who appears in the world, but someone who will reconcile their brokenness and their fallenness. So sin is an equal opportunity employer, and I think that Hindus have to struggle with it just as much as Christians.
We're going to leave it there for the moment. Deepin, thank you so much for being on the program today. If people did want to find out more about Hinduism, where can they find your website?
Certainly, it's certainly on go to our website, www.hinducouncil.org.uk, and certainly more than welcome to ask questions and to look up about what Hinduism is about. But if I can perhaps just come back to Ken with regards to the caste system. Again, this is a misconception which you may want to rectify. The caste system, or the term castas, was a Portuguese term given to Hindus to define them. It was the caste system, or the Varna system, exists to depict society where you have priests, warriors, business people, merchants, and labourers in stratifying society, which is no different to what it is now. And that's all it was, and it was never fixed. In Vedic terms and in Vedic literature, that your caste was never fixed. So just because you were born into a warrior caste did not mean you had to become a warrior. You could change your caste. It got fixed, actually, during the colonial time when the British decided to create a census. So it said, and you had to state what caste you were born into. And that's where it comes from. So that's where the fixed caste system myth comes from. In Vedic times and in Vedic systems, it always depicted the stratification of society, which a person can move up and down, essentially. And within the caste system, right at the top, you had the Brahmins, you had the priests, and below them you had the kings. Now, one thing which is quite important around this fact or this matter was there was a distinct separation of powers. So, for example, the priests could not hold any wealth. So, essentially, they could only give advice for good, for the sake of good, and not for any gain. So priests were the highest caste, but were the poorest in society. So, again, they had a distinct separation of powers. There has been this myth around this caste system, and as for Hindus, it's not only annoying, it's quite false, certainly in terms of how we're being told as Hindus what the caste system is, and whereas we as Hindus know essentially what it is but are never asked. So I'm glad that I've had the opportunity to clear that.
Thank you for that clarification. Ken, do you have anything to add as we close out the program?
Well, I think that this is a great topic for discussion. We live in a pluralistic world. There are lots of religious claims that are made. I think it's exciting to come on your program, to meet Deepin, to talk about what Hindus believe about Krishna, what Christians believe about Jesus. So I'm very excited. I hope some may want to pick up my book and take a look at what I've discovered.
Well, again, the book is God Among Sages, Why Jesus is Not Just Another Religious Leader. I'll make sure there's a link to it and indeed to Ken's website and, of course, the Hindu Council UK as well from today's programme. So if you want to go there and find that, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But for the moment, I'll say thank you very much, Ken and Deepan, for being with me on the programme today.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Gosh, we're suffering the same problem we did last week of me not having really left much time for your feedback at the end of today's programme. I will promise to try and leave a bit more next week so that we get some proper feedback to recent shows. But you may remember last week the main item under discussion was God's hiddenness, and we had a Christian and atheist philosopher debating that. Justin Sheber was our atheist and Blake Junter was our Christian philosopher. The question being, why does God remain hidden sometimes? Could God have good reasons for not revealing himself to someone who is open to God's existence? A really interesting philosophical take on that debate. Kevin says, great show this week, one of my favorites. Can you have a problem of silence part 2 and 3, maybe 4? As you said, only the surface was scratched. I find the silence problem to be the biggest obstacle I've faced with my faith. So grateful for the show. Kevin, yes, I think that the silence issue is slightly different to the hiddenness issue, in my view. Why is God hidden is kind of more the question of why doesn't God just reveal himself in a kind of explicit way, I think. Whereas silence, I think, can be something where a Christian may have had an experience, they believe, of God, but they may go through a significant period of not thinking they're hearing from God. But I think it's absolutely a valid issue to look at. This was from Tim Zeddes. He's an ex-Christian on Facebook, got in touch, saying, regarding this discussion, I was very distressed as I listened to Blake Junter state that God might not want to reveal himself to some non-believers because they might not develop a proper relationship with him. Surely in Christian theology, no one is capable of giving God his due. Isn't that the entire point of the cross? To bridge the gap between a perfect being and imperfect creation, this kind of thinking only separates non-believers into a separate category of humanity. This is, as well as the presuppositionalist accusation against non-believers that they really know God but reject him, is a distressing trend in evangelical apologetics. I hope to hear more generous and loving theologians on your programme in the future. And others, sort of from a other different point of view got in touch. Jeff Foley in Hillsborough, Ohio says the show was astonishing. If a perfectly loving God exists, then he's open to a relationship with any finite person, blah, 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 or something like that. I've never heard of such a God. If such a God exists, we know that the God of the Bible doesn't exist. I know that people don't like the God of the Old Testament. He wiped out the Canaanites without giving even one finite Canaanite a chance to enter into a relationship with him. So let's stick with the God of the New Testament, Jesus. Was he open to a relationship with any finite person? Well, read in John 15, you did not choose me, but I chose you. Matthew 13, that is why I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. It doesn't sound like the Harvey Milquetoast God of Justin Sheber. Justin Sheber can be found in both the Old and New Testaments, where it says, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test in Deuteronomy. There he is, the one putting God to the test. Or, teacher, we wish to see a sign from you. There he is again, seeking a sign from God. He will not see one. Jesus rose from the dead, that's all Justin gets. Then there was something about being non-resistant to belief. What about non-resistant repentance? What about non-resistantly throwing oneself on the mercy of God? I could go on and on and on, says Jeff. Micah says, thank you for your show with Justin Sheber and Blake Junter on Why is God Hidden? Certainly an intriguing topic. I find myself partially sympathetic to and partially frustrated by both guests. Blake had many good suggestions of possible reasons for God to remain hidden, to allow each person to organically develop their moral history and perspectives without the fruits of that important process possibly being overwhelmed and crushed by immediate fuller revelation. Sheba, on the other hand, seemed to me to have a deeper view of God's love pursuing every person, never giving up on anyone, being transformed through a relationship with him. As an evangelical universalist, I think this will all be resolved in the age to come, when God will eventually no longer be hidden to anyone, but with everyone having had some essential journey for tilling the soil in preparation for that. One thing that really concerned me, though, was Blake's repeatedly stating that God is love, but he's also just, as if God's attributes are thought to be pitted against one another with differing goals. God's love is both just and merciful. His justice is merciful and his mercy is just. Would love to hear a show sometime that debates this question on whether God's attributes are really in tension with one another or all in harmony. Thanks again for your excellent podcast. Thank you very much, Micah, for getting in touch. And I'm afraid Micah's will have to conclude this segment of feedback. Many more actually emails that came in on that debate on divine hiddenness last week, so maybe we will have time for more. I genuinely will give more time for the emails next week on the programme. For the moment, thank you very much for joining me on today's edition of Unbelievable. Hope you can come again for the programme at the same time next week. Don't forget, this is really your last chance this week to book in at the early bird rate for Unbelievable, the conference 2017. Saturday the 13th of May, Monday the 13th of March is when the early bird finishes. So get in there at premier.org.uk/whyChrist and join me for what promises to be another fantastic day of learning, thinking and teaching. And I'm really looking forward to someone joining us for that, who joins me on the programme next week. You're unbelievable. Yes, John Lennox is well known as a Christian thinker and a professor of mathematics at Oxford University. He's been on the show a number of times before, but this time we're just sitting down and firing a load of your questions at him. We're asking John Lennox anything. Not too late to get your question in. I'll try and read as many out to him as possible, see what he has to say in response on next week's programme. Send them in to me by the end of this weekend, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. But until next week, have a great one.